Our collective nightmare scientists found a piece of Earth older than your grandfather's grudges. A rock in northern Quebec has been stamped 4.16 billion years old, older than continents, older than civilizations, older than our ability to act responsibly for more than a news cycle. It might hold traces of life from the planet's worst era, the Hadean, which is a polite way of saying Earth used to be an angry furnace and somehow forgave itself. The dating is messy, the evidence is thin. The planet keeps its receipts and doesn't care whether we accept them. Bog lights that used to scare farmers and poets now have a name, microlightning. Tiny electric pops between methane and water bubbles, little sorceries that make will-o'-the-wisps wink at midnight. The same cheap lightning may have been the chemistry that stitched the first life together, microscopic fireworks making amino acids while the rest of the planet was doing nothing special. Life began as a bargain basement electrical show, and here we are, paying attention only when it's fashionable. Magnetic North has been playing ghost. It drifted, sped up, slowed down, and forced the world magnetic model to get another haircut. We update GPS maps because the planet can't commit to a direction. For a species that prides itself on mapping the world, we ignore that the world keeps moving without asking our permission. Your plane will land. Your apps will reroute. The planet will keep changing its mind. A submersible clock ran out and the scientists opened their eyes to a whole underground ocean city where worms and clams live on methane the way shareholders live on other people's work. The Hadal Zone, miles beneath light where pressure is a religion, supports ecosystems that don't need the sun. Microbes turn old carbon into methane, clams host bacteria that eat it for breakfast. Life solves problems by being relentless. People solve problems by arguing over who gets to name them. Beneath our feet, the mantle is not a smooth, polite soup. It is a crowded attic full of old tectonic luggage. Supercontinents left relics there that didn't get thrown out. Hot blobs of rock sit under ancient mountains and refuse to be eroded into polite sediment. The planet carries grudges for millions of years. We carry grudges for 10 minutes between commercials. The inner core misbehaves. Scientists say it reversed spin, then changed shape like a clock whose hands forgot their job. Seismic waves whisper secrets nobody can watch live. And then there's the glorious little joke. Gold is leaking out. A trace found in Hawaiian rock suggests a tiny bit of the core's treasure is migrating upward. The Earth is losing its hoard, inch by inch. We are the species that will see a shiny fragment and immediately begin to file paperwork and permission slips and lawsuits. This is not inspiring. It is not tragic in a romantic way. It's administrative. The planet rewrites its own rulebook while we fill out forms asking for extensions. Things that should be stable are drifting, glitter is escaping, life blooms in places we don't visit, and the deepest secrets of the planet are older and stranger than anything we can legislate or brand. We report the movement. The planet ignores our columns and our committees. We are watching a long, indifferent performance while pretending we can intervene with press releases and half measures. The Earth will keep doing what it has been doing for billions of years, getting stranger, moving on, and leaking gold like it finally decided it had enough of. Keeping score. We will keep reading the notices and acting surprised.
Anthony Joshua walks away with minor bruises, two of his associates are dead, and the internet's immediate crisis management team assembles to fight the real emergency. What this means for next month's pay-per-view. Tragedy. Human lives lost on a road that, by local statistics, is literally one of the deadliest in the country. First world reaction. Trending debates about rematch clauses, fight betters, refreshing odds, and a subset of fans treating grief like a spoiler alert. Don't tell me he's okay. I haven't placed my bet. We live in an economy of attention where condolences come prepackaged for maximum virality. Politicians send X-shaped prayers. Influencers auction off thoughts in exchange for follows. And publicists write six versions of AJ is receiving the best possible care that all end with a quietly placed merch link. The sincerity is optional. The engagement metric is not. Cultural geography gets downgraded to a pop culture pinball. A stretch of Nigerian highway with hundreds of fatalities becomes a headline only because a famous body had a close call on it. Otherwise, it's a pothole in the global algorithm, until a celebrity drives over it. Then we learn its name, its death toll, and whether there will be a sequel bout. Speeding and wrongful overtaking cause most fatal crashes on that corridor. In the tweet storm, responsibility gets reduced to a scheduling problem. Will AJ be back for the trilogy? Meanwhile, the people who actually worked with him are not listed as fight card placeholders. Comedy used to punch up. Now it clicks like a remote, refresh, react, monetize. We want to be shocked, but not inconvenienced. We want closure. but only if it fits our weekend plans. The hardest part for first world audiences is that life refuses to be postable on schedule. So we perform grief like it's a technical difficulty until the stream returns. Punchlines are cheap, and so are we. Furious that a heavyweight might miss a date, quietly uncomfortable that roads exist where death isn't a subplot. The real heavy hit is not a broken jaw or a rescheduled fight, it's how quickly a human story is repackaged into something we can complain about between coffee breaks.
The latest installment of American Mercy came by sea. A U.S. strike in the Eastern Pacific on December 29th killed two people on a vessel the military called a drug trafficker. SOUTHCOM announced the hit was ordered by Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and carried out by Joint Task Force Southern Spear in International Waters. Two dead, no U.S. casualties. Move along. This is part of Operation Southern Spear, which has now left at least 107 people dead. The administration calls them unlawful combatants and relies on a classified Justice Department opinion to claim the right to kill without judicial review. Classified legality, the modern catchphrase that keeps extrajudicial violence looking tidy. A week earlier, there was another strike on a low-profile vessel. Little boats, big consequences. Members of Congress and human rights groups have raised objections. The administration treats that as background noise. Accountability gets promoted into an optional luxury when kinetic action boosts the optics of toughness. President Trump says the U.S. also took out a big facility where drugs are supposedly loaded onto boats. He described a major explosion in a dock area. Venezuela, oddly, has no confirmed reports of any such ruined facility. Meanwhile, Washington has massed ships and troops in the Caribbean and imposed a blockade on sanctioned oil tankers. Blockade, strike, muscle flex, the three-step foreign policy routine. Trump flirts with the language of invasion, suggesting land strikes and saying it would be smart if Nicolas Maduro stepped down. Maduro calls the buildup psychological terrorism. Venezuela's legislature answered by approving prison terms up to 20 years for anyone accused of supporting, quote, piracy or blockades. Two, governments ratcheting up pressure and punishment, each claiming to be the reasonable one. What we are watching is the normalizing of a few simple mechanics. Classify people out of civil protections, sign off on lethal force in secret, militarize a region, and use the evidence of explosions to smooth public opinion. If any of this raises legal or ethical questions, the response is to call them technicalities or label the critics soft. The dull comedy is that all of it gets packaged as drug interdiction and national security. The darker truth is that it looks like a template. Secrecy as legality, force as policy, sanctions and blockades as pretexts for broader coercion. Civilians die, law gets bypassed, and the theater of justification keeps rolling. This is what a slow slide feels like. Mechanized, bureaucratic, and sold as inevitable. We've outsourced judgment to classified memos and missiles, and the result is routine violence that nobody in power has to explain in public.
This piece is based on the article Americans in 1998 Tried to Predict 2025. Here's what they got right. Drawn from Gallup and USA Today polling archived at the Roper Center at Cornell University, 1998 feels like a different planet. Bill Clinton was auditioning for future historical footnotes, Titanic was sweeping the Oscars like a polite ocean liner, and our phones were wedded to the walls. People answered pollsters from their landlines and made confident forecasts about a year they could not possibly imagine. Some predictions landed. A black president, checked. Legal, commonplace gay marriage, checked. A deadly new disease, checked, though nobody specified the preferred timetable for pandemics. These hits read like the future was a predictable spreadsheet. It wasn't. It was a messy human thing, full of accidents and choices and inconvenient viruses. Other predictions were, in the kindest light, optimistic. Two-thirds thought a woman would be president by now. More than half expected a cure for cancer. 61% believed routine centenarians would populate our neighborhoods. The future they ordered was an aspirational Amazon wish list. The universe shipped a different box. The poll wasn't all medical miracles and progressive triumphs. Respondents foresaw widening inequality, richer lives improving while the poor suffered more. They imagined less privacy, diminished personal freedom, higher crime, worse environment, lower moral values. Those aren't flashy hits or misses. They're the slow burn of policy decisions, technology, and human neglect. Many of those anxieties look less like prophecy and more like a weather report we ignored until the storm arrived. There's a small, sharp irony in that optimism about race relations. And medical availability coexists with a fear that those same goods would be less affordable or distributed. People predicted better treatments and worse access. They guessed at progress, but expected the price tag to be attached to the progress itself. That's a neat summary of human hope. Invent better things, then fence them off. And the satisfaction numbers are deliciously bleak. In 1998, about 60% of Americans said things were going well. In 2025, that's down to 24%. We've become better at imagining futures and worse at being content in this one. We make elaborate projections from the comfort of a landline, then live the consequences in an era our grandparents would barely recognize and our children take for granted. The real existential punchline: predicting the future is less about accuracy and more about revealing what we fear and what we want. The forecasts tell us who we're in 1998. Cautious, anxious, hopeful, and how those impulses shaped what actually happened. We are proud of our foresight when we're right, outraged when we're wrong, and otherwise left to collect the receipts. Humans like to think of the future as a place to arrive, a destination you can plan for. But mostly it's a conversation starter we keep having with ourselves, across decades and broken landlines. We'll keep guessing. The future will keep answering. Sometimes politely, often with indifference, and occasionally with the dark, comic timing of a punchline we should have seen coming.
A new Avatar sequel shoves its chrome-plated spectacle into the maw of year-end commerce, and the crowd obliges. Fire and Ash pulls another $64 million domestically over a weekend, and $181.2 million overseas. A $760.4 million global concussion that reads less like art and more like a ledger flashing green. The movie's $96 million haul on IMAX isn't a triumph of taste so much as proof that we will pay extra to have our senses upsold. Price-sensitive consumers somehow surrender to premium formats when the lights go dark and the logo-branded thrill is served. This is not popularity, it is market conditioning. Franchises are scaffolding for an economy that has outsourced imagination to IP and spectacle. The Avatar machine, tanked, tuned, and reheated across decades, reminds us how cultural life is now a production schedule, a fiscal quarter, a battalion of technicians and accountants whose job is to extract maximum attendance and ancillary revenue, that Warner Brothers Discovery owns news outlets while a handful of conglomerates own the megaphone, makes the applause appear organic and inevitable when it is edited, amplified, and monetized. Around it, the box office reads like sanitized evidence of a broken system trying to reassure itself. Zootopia 2 inches climbs to $1.4 billion because comforting franchises sell in bulk. PG Films pulled $2.87 billion, outstripping edgier PG-13 fare, revealing that risk has become a boutique commodity and familiarity is the primary growth strategy. Small studio prestige gets turbocharged by social media. A24's Marty Supreme swells from six theaters to thousands, fueled by algorithmic fandom and targeted buzz. The Marty Army is less a cultural movement than a crowd management tactic. Youthful energy repackaged into measurable box office swings investors can point to, a smorgasbord of releases, remakes, faith-based epics, animated sequels, award season hopefuls, stack the calendar like a hedge fund's diversified portfolio. Each title is a checkbox, demographic, format, holiday, collectible merch potential. Theaters become temples, where the congregation flashes a credit card and buys meaning by the ounce. Best Christmas week since 2020, the analysts say, and the numbers still sit at $8.76 billion for the year, up a hair from last year, but shrinking compared with 2019. The rhetoric of recovery exists to paper over permanent decline, marginal gains, cozy headlines, and endless promises of a blockbuster pipeline that will save theaters next year. Predictions are sold with trailers, Super Mario, Toy Story 5, Avengers, Doomsday, Dune Part 3. The future is more of the same in bigger fonts and higher ticket tiers. Premium formats, celebrity-engineered nostalgia, and algorithm-sourced fandom are not symptoms of vitality. They are emergency measures to prop up an industry that converted human attention into subscription models, ad inventory, and high-margin sensory experiences. Everything about this weekend's box office glow signals a society that will pay extra to be told what to feel. The spectacle distracts from the emptiness it commodifies. Community replaced by curated events, art rebranded as a consumable thrill, and collective experience bartered away for another limited edition showing in giant screens and stadium sound. The fever dream persists because it is profitable, until the profit motive cannibalizes the very rituals it depends on, and then we'll sell the nostalgia back to the audience in 3D.